Okay. So let me just lay out the basic ideas of this general approach to the micro foundations of class formation. A little comment on this expression, micro foundations. Micro foundations. We'll encounter that idea of micro foundations especially sharply when we discuss ideology. Because the key idea of in the section on ideology, at least the way I'm going to frame the problem of ideology, is that the problem of ideology is not primarily a problem of understanding how the different ideas of an ideology fit together. Rather, it's understanding how ideology shapes the subjectivities of people. That's what's in play in the ideology. That's why the study of ideology matters for an account of social change, is because ideology gets embodied in the subjectivity of actors. And the micro problem of ideology is understanding how it comes to pass that a body of ideas in a discourse, in a way of talking about the world, how those ideas actually get embodied in people's subjectivity, so it actually works in the world rather than just works on paper. And that translation into the subjectivity of actors is the problem of the micro foundations of ideology. Faye, here's your two. Here, we can pass it. And the formatting problem, I was saying to the class, the formatting problem on your paper wasn't so... The formatting problem wasn't so serious. You didn't really need to go and reprint them, because this is totally readable. It doesn't affect the... But if you did reprint it, then people have a... Okay. So the two of you, whoever retrieved her paper, should, after class, just grab the new copies. All right, so what I'm going to do... Following the work, especially of Jan Elster. I mean, Jan Elster is a Norwegian sort of philosopher, political theorist who writes on all sorts of topics. His hallmark is very sharply focused explorations of a very diverse set of problems. It's both a strength and a frustration of his work, from my point of view, that he has these fantastically interesting interventions into a particular set of problems. It launches interesting debates, and then he moves on to something else, rather than sticks with any given problem for an extended period of time. It's produced a really remarkable set of books and interventions on his part, some of which I think are really quite deep, but he doesn't stick with them, you know, to play it fully out. He isn't a major contributor to game theory, you know, in the sense of having been one of the people who has helped formulate this as a framework of analysis in social science, but he's one of the best theorists that I know of. Well, I would say he is the best theorist that I know of for figuring out precisely what the standing of game theory is within the social sciences and how to think about its role in generating theory. And he has a number of just excellent pieces on that. So this is more or less tracking, with some slight differences, more or less tracking his way of framing this problem. I think, in fact, a slightly better name for game theory would be strategic interaction theory. The name game theory was given to this way of approaching social issues by, I think, the mathematical formulations, the people who were working on in the mathematics of it at the very beginning of the development of these ideas, and the name just kind of stuck as the rubric for it. It's a little misleading only because a game is just a metaphor for a context where there are strategic interactions. But many of the problems that are studied are not, quote, games in the sense that we would ordinarily think of a game. And some people feel that that has such a flippant and trivial aura to it that part of the negative reaction, especially by radicals to game theory, I think part of it comes a little bit from the fact that it's called that. If it was called strategic interaction theory, which is what it is, there'd be less hostility to it. Elster, indeed, argues that Marx was a game theorist, that although the formal apparatus of game theory wasn't there, many of his arguments about class struggle precisely track the kind of arguments that a game theorist would make. So, first point, game theory is a way of thinking about class struggle and class formation. It's not a way of providing complete explanations, but it's a way of creating the context for the development of complete explanations. The classic example is the prisoner's dilemma. Now, I assume that this is familiar to most of you. I would ask for a show of hands, but I don't want to embarrass anybody if they feel that they ought to know what the prisoner's dilemma is and don't. Let me just rehearse it for you, just remind you what the idea of the prisoner's dilemma is. We'll be talking about this more systematically in the next lecture. So here's the classic story. Two actors are arrested, and they are each asked to confess to the crime, and they're given two choices. You either confess, saying that both of you did it, or you can remain silent. Those are your two choices. The two prisoners are separated from each other, and they are told the following. If you remain silent and the other person confesses, you will get 10 years in prison and the other prisoner will get 2. If you both remain silent, you each get 5 years. The other prisoner gets off free. If the other guy confesses and you're silent, you get 10, the other guy gets 0. If you both confess, you both get 5. If neither of you confesses, if you both remain silent, you both get 2. Right? So those are the options. Now, everybody prefers 5 years to 10, and 2 years to 5, and no years to 2. So each prisoner only cares about what they get. They all would prefer to get off. Their second choice is 2. The third choice is 3. The worst option is 10. Now, what happens in this situation? And what game theory shows, it shows it correctly. This is not, there's no error here. What they show is, inevitably, in a deterministic manner, if it is true that the prisoners only care about their own well-being, and if those are the choices, they end up each getting 5 years in prison. That is, they both confess. Whereas if they had both remained silent, they would have gotten 2 years. And it will never happen that they'll both remain silent. Under the assumption that they're both rational, they don't make mistakes, and they're both self-interested. Now that's a puzzle, because the normal way people think is that if people act rationally, they are going to maximize their individual alternative, and they wouldn't, if they both prefer 2 over 5, why don't they end up with 2? That is, both remaining silent. Well, it's a standard kind of argument. The way, since you can't affect the other person's behavior, the way to approach this is to say, okay, if the other person remains silent, what's my best strategy? If they remain silent, my best strategy is to confess, because then I get off, I get 0. What's my best strategy if they confess? Well, it's to confess, because then I get 5 instead of 10. So regardless of what the other person does, my best strategy is to confess. The other person thinks the same way. We both confess, we both end up with 5. Whereas if we had both remained silent, we would have ended up with 2 years in prison. Well, that's the model of the prisoner's dilemma. It turns out that that has very general application to social life. That it's a pretty deep understanding. It's a understanding of the interconnectedness of our choices and the consequences. And that's the key problem here, is that the outcomes for you depend not just on your own choices, but on other people's choices. You do not control your own outcome independently of what other people are choosing. And that's why this is a strategic interaction model called game theory. Well, radical theorists object to game theory. They have 3 standard objections. They object to the egoism that it implies people are only interested in their own well-being. They object to the rationality assumption that people are hyper-rational in the way game theory suggests. And they object to the idea that people's actions are explained primarily in terms of intentions and choice. They object to all 3 of those elements. And it's true that game theory, at least in some forms, assumes egoism, rationality, and choice and constraint as the basis for understanding action. But neither of these objections, I think, actually constitutes a legitimate objection to game theory. First, egoism. Game theory doesn't actually imply that people are selfish. That's not even a working assumption in game theory. It's an assumption in some particular in models, like the prisoner's dilemma. But as we'll see, we'll be exploring some models in game theory which are crucial for understanding solidarity, in which unselfish preferences are key to understanding how solidarity works. A key part of solidarity is the shift of people's preferences from pure selfishness to what Elster calls conditional altruism. That is, people want to be altruistic, but only if they have confidence that a fair percentage of other people are acting altruistically. They don't want to be unilateral altruists that simply act as if everybody was altruistic. They're conditional altruists. Well, that's a rejection of the egoism assumption. So the criticism that rational choice theory assumes people are selfish is simply a misreading of the theory. It doesn't. There's plenty of game theory models that assume that actors are acting through altruistic and other kinds of motives, preferences, not just selfish motives. The rationality assumption. Now, this is a little bit more accurate. That is, virtually all, or the majority certainly, of game theory models do assume that people are acting rationally. That is, they're not making mistakes in their choices, given their preferences. So given what they want in the world, they're making the best choice they can. That's all that rationality means, is that you're not making mistakes. But even that assumption, the most sophisticated contemporary game theorists allow for mistakes. They have a variety of ways of introducing the tendency for people to operate on poor information or to be myopic, to have short time horizons, you know, to think too short a time horizon, to make decisions based on short time horizons when their preferences are longer. So even on the rationality issue, there's a fair amount of interesting work which pulls back from pure rationality. But the other thing that just to remember is that the rationality assumption is a way of making a model clear, so that then when you study the real world, you can examine departures from the model. It's not meant to imply that in the world people actually always act that way. Finally, on the key issue, of choice versus constraint. Game theory doesn't imply that if we want to analyze variations across time and place in class formations and class struggles or anything else, that the most important thing are variations in the choices, intentions, and strategies of actors, rather than variations in the social structure or constraints within which people make the choices. There's no assumption that it's actually choices that are the key thing which are explaining outcomes, as opposed to the broad social structures that define what choices are available. It's even possible that in specific cases, the objective constraints, that is, the constraints in the environment, which determine the set of possibilities by actors, means that the set of possibilities gets narrowed down to a single possibility, although that's rare, in which case the act of choosing becomes irrelevant. There's nothing in the existence of game theory that implies that the key problem to solve is why people choose among the available options, as opposed to the problem, why are there so few options available for people to choose. The use of strategic action models, then, is important in this respect because it helps you distinguish between a causal environment in which the real problem is people face such limited choices, rather than the problem is what choice they make within those limits. Strategic action theory is entirely relevant for understanding why, in the American political context, the alternatives people face when they vote is of such limited character, rather than just explaining why they vote the way they do, given those constraints. All right. I think the radical objections are wrong-headed, but I also believe that they have a correct intuition that by itself, game theory provides only a crucial foundation for producing explanations, but there should be no presumption that the explanations are complete within it. Finally, just one last bit of clarification. To understand the value of game theory, I think it's useful to contrast three general ways of understanding human action in general. These are three broad ways of understanding human action and the participation of individuals in struggles. So ultimately, that's what we care about. Why do people engage or not engage in struggles the way they do? How do we explain this? And there are, I think, in the social sciences, fundamentally three kinds of explanations for the behavior of people. The first is that action is scripted. We follow scripts. People are socialized that instill norms and values. These are inculcated into the subjectivity of actors. With these inculcated norms, people fill roles in society in which their actions are essentially dictated by the norms that govern roles. This is basically Pierre Bourdieu's explanation for behavior. He uses the term habitus to describe this. People are programmed to act through habit, ritual, routine, and convention. In this way of understanding social interactions, that is, our behaviors are scripted, our experience of choice is mostly an illusion. Participation in collective struggles is explained by the way norms and values govern our behavior, not by the process by which people deliberate and consciously make choices. The choices are pretty much epiphenomenal. We experience them, but they don't matter. That is, they don't matter because they're not explanatory. What's explanatory is how we are programmed. Well, I've said it in a harsh and sharp way. Relatively few theorists will say, yes, that's exactly what I meant. But in practice, that's what a lot of theories amount to. And I think Bourdieu's habitus account comes very close to seeing people as programmed to fulfill roles and enact the scripts. The second mode of explanation is that people make choices under constraints. They do make choices, and their actions must be viewed at least partially explained by their intentions or purposes. The choices may be norm-driven or goal-driven, but the action that occurs is consciously chosen rather than programmed by ritual or habit. By goal-driven, I mean the choices made instrumentally to accomplish the goal. So if your actions are goal-driven, it means you consciously do something to achieve that goal, whatever the goal might be. Norm-driven, I mean that the choices of action is made to conform to some norm, that you consciously make choices in order to follow some rule, some norm. But it's still a conscious choice to follow the rule as opposed to just a habit, a routine behavior. Now, this doesn't deny that a lot of what we do is habit. And we know that habits are absolutely central to understanding language. I mean, our ability to speak rapidly and coherently and have other people understand what we're saying is the result not of a conscious choice to follow the rules of grammar in every sentence we use or a conscious picking of every word that fits into a sentence, you know, consciously choosing the words one by one. When you're learning a foreign language, that's what you're doing, and that's why it's so hard to speak a foreign language initially. But it becomes entirely internalized in a way that is automatic. So habit is important. It's just that it's not adequate for explaining the actual actions of people because goal-driven and norm-driven choices play an important role. And this is captured by saying that action is intentional or purposeful. Sometimes people say action is meaningful, but that's still basically in the same domain. It's saying that people are making choices in light of the meanings that the actions have to them. But they're still acting through their intentions, their purposes. In the second formulation, actions are intentional but not strategic. The third way of explaining behavior is to say that our actions are, in some circumstances but not all, strategic. That is, people make choices under constraints in a world in which they know that other actors are also making choices under constraints. Our choices, therefore, take into account consciously, in one way or another, our expectations about the choices of others. That is, whenever you engage in an action, in an activity, you make a choice in which part of the process by which you choose what to do is an understanding of other people's choices. Whenever you do that, you're acting strategically. That's all that strategy means, is to act in a way that takes into account the actions of others. That is not just acting intentionally with purposes, it's acting intentionally with purposes in a context where the outcome of your actions depends upon what other people do. Normally when you go shopping, you're not acting strategically, you're acting just intentionally. You go to a store, you're looking for what you want, and you buy, you make a choice. But on the Friday after Thanksgiving, when there are sales, in which a store announces the doors will open at 5 a.m., and there will be 50 televisions available that are going to be sold at 25% of their normal price. You know, they do this, right? That there's in this big television store, there's 50 big screen televisions that will be 75% off. Well, then you know that how early you line up in front of the store is going to determine the likelihood of your getting the television. And therefore, you make a choice to get up at 3 in the morning and line up an hour ahead of time in order to be among the first 50. If the store had announced that when you come into the store, you will sign up for a lottery, and at the end of the day, we will give 50 people a television at 75% off, then you would show up at 10 in the morning. Right? Now that is a strategic, that's a simple-minded one, that's a strategic analysis. You know how other people behave. You know that there's enough people in this community who are crazy enough to get up at 3 in the morning to line up in front of the store. You know that you can't realize your goal without taking into account other people's behavior. And so you act strategically. Now, that's all that game theory is. It's just saying we live in a strategic world. And where there are conflicts of interest, and that, here's the kind of key thing, where there are conflicts of interest, it turns out that strategic action is very important. It plays a very big role in the extent to which your interests can be realized. Elster lays out in his account, and I, since it's in the paper, in the chapter that is assigned from Elster, I won't explain each of these, the essential logic of this strategic interaction, what it means to have this interdependency of choices and constraints of multiple actors. The reward, and I'll just read them, but I won't explain them. The reward of each person is dependent upon the choices of everybody, not just your own choice. The reward of each person depends upon the rewards of all, not just the reward of one. And the choice of each depends upon the choice of all. These are three kinds of interdependencies, and taken together, that's what strategic action theory is about. Okay, well, 25 minutes for discussion on this opening gambit in our exploration of class formation. Questions, issues? Clarifications? Remember my warning on the very first class that you should always come prepared for some issue connected to a topic, since if no one says anything, I'll just randomly call on someone. Yeah, you saved this. You saved the class from agony.
So, when Lo is explaining social action, are they potentially interconnected? Like, you have different ones kind of weighing in on what somebody does, or are they mutually exclusive?
Oh no, these are not mutually exclusive. I think a lot of behavior is habitual. I think it's actually crucial for any social order, whether it be egalitarian or oppressive, that most of the time, most of what people do is by virtue of having successfully internalized the ordinary rules of the game for how you behave in settings. And it's one of the reasons why it's often very awkward when you go to a new cultural context where you don't have those internalized habits of interaction, and you don't know how to interpret what other people are doing because you don't know the cues, you don't have the language of interaction, quite apart from the language of discourse. And learning that kind of rules to make life smooth and easy is part of what it means to be acculturated. So the habitual scripted action is important. Intentional action that is not interaction is also important, for obvious reasons. But the argument then here is that you always have those first two kinds of explanations, but they're not sufficient to really richly understand contexts of conflict, which, broadly we can think of these as political practices of people. But it applies for the shopping example, too. There's plenty of contexts in which if all you know is habit and intention, you wouldn't know why people get up at 3 in the morning. It's not just out of habit that they get up at 3 in the morning for a 5 o'clock, Black Friday sale. No, it's because they have knowledge about the behavior of other people and are making their choices in light of that behavior. Yeah.
So, do you think that the skepticism of like radical theorists to game theory and such, because of the way, or the types of questions that have been asked using game theory, like that, you know, they're not in political science or classical economics, that they're not concerned about emancipation or whatever, and so is that changing? Can you give an example of like, you know, a way that game theory analysis has been used to like inform or explain something more in the spirit of emancipation?
So it's undoubtedly the case that most political scientists and economists don't ask emancipatory questions, but it isn't by virtue of them using game theory, it's by virtue of them being conventional political scientists and economists who don't ask emancipatory questions regardless of what their methodologies are. Lots of people in sociology who work on social movements are concerned about radical social change. And they nevertheless will be, when they develop their explanations for why movements succeed and fail and how they choose their strategies, have at least as a context of the explanation the problems that have been sharpened by game theory. And it's often the case, even when they reject game theory, they operate in the shadow of game theory. So the shadow of game theory says that the collective action failures are something that any social movement has to contend with. It has to find solutions to maintain solidarity in the face of the tendency for people to defect when they get gains from the collective action, even if they don't participate, if the participation is costly. So a lot of what social movements talk about then are the ways in which people get benefits from participation from in-process benefits. That's called selective incentives. You know, so there's a lot of discussion about how you create selective incentives. So there's incentives for being in the movement rather than being on the outside. Or how various kinds of shifts in preferences create motivations for participating independently of the costs and benefits. You know, or how in various kinds of conflict settings there are costs that are imposed on actors for defecting. You know, various kinds of punishments that get. So you wouldn't explore those questions unless you had a strategic action idea. Now, some of those issues were talked about even before game theory developed. As Elster says, Marx was a game theorist implicitly. What game theory then gives you is greater precision in your understanding of how those problems affect the outcome in question. You know, and I think that the hesitation that radicals have had has probably been heavily shaped by the association with mathematical economics of game theory. You know, the fact that that's the heart of where it's been developed in its most elaborate way. And there's just this general suspicion of that discipline. And in the specific Marxian case, it's because of a characterization of economics as bourgeois economics. And it's tainted by virtue of its ideological connection to supporting and defending capitalist institutions. And that, I think, though, just leads people to make intellectual errors, you know, to mistake the methodological precepts with the substantive purposes to which they've been used. Choi Yi, and then Maddie.
Okay, just try to clarify. So is what you think that like the game theory is a good approach to understand how the social action works? Like even, you know, we could combine it with the labor theory, labor value theory, you know, like quantitatively measure how people take different actions.
So game theory and the labor theory of value have nothing to do with each other, because the word theory is being used in completely different contexts here. So game theory is a way of understanding human behavior. The labor theory of value is not a way of understanding human behavior, why people behave the way they do. It's a way of accounting for the consequences of certain kinds of actions of people. It's a way of accounting for the quantitative values of the products of what people do when they engage in economic activity, but it's not part of an explanation of the activity itself. It doesn't explain why workers go to work. They go to work because they are separated from the means of production and they can't get their subsistence other than working. Whether or not the value of what they produce is measured appropriately by the abstract necessary labor time does not bear on the question of why do workers go to work every day. They go to work every day for a wholly different kind of set of explanatory reasons. So you could certainly, if you wanted to, you could certainly combine the labor theory of value with strategic action theory. The labor theory of value would tell you something about the rate of exploitation and the prices at which things exchange, and the strategic action theory would tell you about the strategies of capitalists and workers engaged in production and distribution. You could combine it, but the more relevant issue is that you combine strategic action theory with intentional action theory, with scripted action theory, that each of these ways of theorizing action, scripts, intentions, and strategies, each of these are relevant to every context, but some may be more relevant to a given problem. So you have to say, what am I trying to explain? And for some answers to the question, what I'm trying to explain, understanding the different scripts in different places are really where the action is. If you want to explain the behavior of people at cocktail parties, you know, in different, if you're an academic and you go to conferences around the world and in the receptions after conferences, the behavior of people can be quite different, and you want to explain why is the behavior of a cocktail party in Japan so different from the behavior of people in a cocktail party in Wisconsin, a reception in Wisconsin. I don't think that the main action there is strategic action theory. There may be some, you know, it may bear on it a little bit. It way more has to do with scripted behavior, internalized norms of the appropriate way you're supposed to behave in the presence of alcohol at an academic setting. So in Japan, well, this is an overstatement, but in Japan, when I've been in after academic settings, after the official events, in the presence of alcohol, people get sloppy drunk, and that never happens.
Still true.
You know, that just does not happen in an American academic setting. That when you have, you know, you're having an international event and people are coming together and there's wine or alcohol afterwards, people do not get sloppy drunk, and if they do, it's seen as very bad behavior. Whereas in Japan, that, at least in my experience, that was not true. I doubt if that's mostly because of strategic action. You know, there may be a strategic action background condition to it that sort of helps explain why these norms got to be the way they are, but it's really about the scripts. But for other problems, you know, scripts may not be very interesting. Maddie.
This is a somewhat similar question. I'm just clarifying that game theory attempts to solve, like, the six issues that you pose to why interests alone cannot explain class formations, right?
Well, it's part, yes. Game theory will say as a key reason among these six reasons, the fifth one, the collective action dilemmas, is the one that's most centrally concerned with saying yes, and there's a strategic interaction problem, and the power one. The fifth and sixth one would be the ones that are most crucial for that. The lived experience and multidimensionality issues might have more to do with understanding how scripts are different in different places, or how the purposes of actors are different, that is, the intentional explanation, are different in different contexts. So, but you're right, of course, that game theory is a, given these six things, and you say, well, what the hell am I going to do? How am I going to explain things? You would certainly not, after reading all six of these, say, we just need better scripts. We haven't fully understood the scripted nature of behavior. No, you'd say that's not a good solution. And if somebody said, well, we just really haven't understood well enough the purposes of action. And you'd say, no, that might be relevant for one, two, and three. Those three really say that the purposes are more complicated. But they don't help you enough to understand the fifth and sixth.
One of the criticisms that you leveled against people who tend to favor scripted action in a very kind of narrow way was that in practice, even though they didn't claim that scripted action dictates all of like social life, it sort of is what it boiled down to. Could this criticism also then be leveled at game theory by saying that in practice, game theory, even though game theorists don't claim in their paper, this model explains all of reality or you know how social life exists in this way, that it's still too simple, or that game theory is still too simplistic to explain the complexity of reality.
I think I might have given this little homily before, but I'll do it again anyway. The question of something being too simplistic is it's a nice, easy criticism to make. I mean, I'm not saying you're just making a sloppy criticism. It's an easy criticism to make of everything, that it's too simplistic. I think the bigger danger in explanations is that they're too complicated. I'd rather have an overly simplified explanation than an overly complexified explanation of something. And the reason is, if it's overly simplified, it's still likely to give you real insight, and then you say, but we need to add this complexity to really understand everything. Whereas overly complexified means it's hard to figure out what's really going on. You've got, too much detail, too many arguments, and it ends up being an obstruction to insights into the deeper way things are going. Now, oversimplification then is a correct criticism when somebody denies that they're being oversimplified, that they've done a simplification, when they say, this is not merely a way of understanding some of the processes at work with clarity, but this is an adequate and complete explanation of everything that went on, and nothing else is important. Well, then you can say, no, it's not true that nothing else is important. You're wrong. You've oversimplified. You're wrong because you can't explain this feature of the struggle, why there were some communities that just stayed in the struggle in spite of the fact it was clear they were going to lose. Why did they do that? You can't explain that without invoking the depth of their moral commitment and their willingness to persist because of the depth of that moral commitment in spite of their knowledge that they were going to fail. Well, that explanation, why you'd have that depth of commitment, requires explaining meaningful action, the meanings of action, which is part of that second that intermediate one. Why people act in ways that affirm the meaning of their lives. That's part of intentional action. It's unlikely that that deep persistence and unwillingness to give up is just scripted. That doesn't feel right. You know, when it could be, you know, people could be robotically committed to something. But when a group of people engage in a struggle to the end, in spite of the devastation it's causing, to say they're just doing it out of habit and ritual and routine doesn't ring true. Rather, what rings true is they're just so deeply committed to those purposes that they are consciously continuing it, knowing that the strategic environment is such that they're not going to succeed. So strategic action theory doesn't give you a good take on it, and scripted doesn't. You've got to have that intermediate one. And if a strategic action theorist, so this is a long-winded way of answering your question, if they reject in principle the role of that kind of explanation, then they're being silly. You know, they're just incorrect. If they say, however, the explanation for the failure of this movement, not for the persistence of this hardcore group that never give up, but the overall failure is the breakdown of solidarity due to the increasing costs of participation, and that was due to the strategic environment, then they've provided a good core explanation for part of the phenomena, but not for all of it. And then, you know, a good radical theorist would say, yes, that's right, but you forgot this bit. Yeah?
I want to put a fundamental kind of epistemological puzzle in the core of the reason. What is the source of definition of class interests? If they're assigned by theorists, then on what grounds? Do people's subjective views matter in this respect? Is it correct at all to think for people and kind of instead of people? What if some strive, for instance, not for freedom, emancipation, or solidarity, but for dominance over others, alternative lifestyles, or even suffering? On the other side, if we try to understand people's opinion, how can we come up with common interests?
So I don't think that material interests are assigned by theorists. They may be discovered by theorists, but they're assigned by relations. They're assigned in the world. All that material interests, the claim about material interests are, is a claim that by virtue of being in a class structure, your material conditions of life will be affected in the following ways. If you want to improve your material conditions of life, you have the following trade-offs that you face. Capitalists get their material conditions of life from their ownership of the means of production and their ability to extract labor effort from workers. And that's objectively true. Whether or not they believe it's true doesn't matter. It is a true description of where they get their material conditions of life. If a capitalist comes to you and then asks, what do I have to do to secure and maintain my material conditions of life? The answer is, well, if that's what you are asking, then here are the objective facts of the matter. That is how you get your material conditions of life. And the same thing you could say to workers. So material interests are objective. People can be mistaken about what is in their material interests. That's different from saying they're mistaken about what is in their interests. You know, tout court, as you say in French, you know, just as a general statement, because what's in your interest depends upon how you weigh your material interests against other kinds of interests. So Engels bankrolls Marx to write Das Kapital. You know, Engels finances the writing of the greatest work in the history of leftist thinking. He is a capitalist. He gets his money from cotton manufacturing in Manchester. Now, would we want to say Engels is not acting in Engels' interests? No, Engels was acting in his interests, but he was not acting in his class interests. And it wasn't that he was mistaken about his class interests. He chose to act against his class. And that's the proper description of it. The proper description is, he weighed his material interests as a member of the capitalist class and his human interests as a, you know, member of the European intelligentsia committed to social emancipation. He weighed those two interests, which are in sharp conflict in the case of a bourgeois intellectual of Engels' sort. He weighed them by saying he's not going to give a hoot about his class interests. Now, he gave enough of a hoot about it to say it is worthwhile to maintain and not to worry about my personal, you know, connection to the capitalist class. He did not live extravagantly, but he lived well. He didn't give away all of his money. He didn't liquidate his firm on the grounds that he didn't want to get his hands dirty. No, he said, I don't know if he said it in quite this language. You know, I'm a capitalist exploiter of the working class of Manchester. I've got access to these resources. I'm going to redirect the surplus that I control towards the Second International, towards working class struggles, towards Karl Marx. So I do think material interests are objective. They are given independently of the consciousness of people. People can screw up and misunderstand them. They can be informed of them. Those are discoveries by theorists. They're not impositions by theorists.
But people still can want these interests, or these class interests, or they want not.
Right, absolutely. But they may not want them because they don't understand them, as opposed to they may not want them because they have decided that they're not important. Okay? I mean, that's the way I think you have to, one ought to think about these things. Okay. See you all on Thursday.